What I'd like to speak with you about today is what I call the Great Internet Backlash. And my subtitle is Finding the Cost of Freedom. I want to share some ideas with you, some stories from my own experience, and close with what I hope is at least an interesting, if not plausible, recommendation for ways in which we can learn from the Great Internet Backlash not to shut down the internet or build little kill zones for the wireless in our classrooms. The suggestion is being taken seriously in some schools, I regret to say. But what we can learn instead suggests ways in which we can use the internet for the amazing purposes with which it was designed. The early visionaries of the internet had in mind the kind of collaborative, mutually stimulating environment that I think is very much at the heart of what we prize in education. We're not there for a number of reasons, not because the internet is bad, but because we don't quite yet understand or accept what is best about it. So many of you, I think, have seen the cover of Wired magazine proclaiming the web is dead. This was briefly upsetting to me before I saw several blog posts and YouTube videos cataloging all the things Wired magazine has said is dead over the last few years. It's quite an impressive catalog. They were right about the floppy disk. All the rest were wrong, I'm pleased to say. And as one commentator pointed out, Wired magazine has never said the magazine is dead. But certainly, it's at least on life support. Recently, there's been a whole slate of dire warnings. Really good and useful cautions, but in my view, taken to, in many cases, an hysterical extreme, warning us that not only is the web dead, but it would be better off dead, and we'd all be much better off if it were. This is a book called You Are Not a Gadget, a manifesto, which had a particular kind of clout because Jerome Lanier is himself a computer scientist, someone who helped to build the architecture of the internet and the World Wide Web and the computers we use to connect with each other on it. Now, I'm going to return to Lanier in a little bit towards the end of the talk. I find that his thinking is, of the great internet backlashers, some of the most interesting and helpful. But even Lanier gets his knickers in a twist when he thinks about things like Wikipedia, which is one of the things that I'm going to try to work through and explore today. And Lanier writes, when developers of digital technologies design a program that requires you to interact with a computer as if it were a person, they ask you to accept in some corner of your brain that you might also be conceived of as a program. But of course, you might, but leave that aside. When they design an internet service that is edited by a vast anonymous crowd, and that's got to be Wikipedia, they are suggesting that a random crowd of humans is an organism with a legitimate point of view. There is some fear embedded here in this particular aspect of the backlash that has to do with this dread of the hive mind. And if, like me, you have every single episode of Star Trek The Next Generation on DVD, soon to be made obsolete by what I hope will be the high-res version of Star Trek The Next Generation, you know that some of the most horrific visions to emerge from that series had to do with the Borg. They were part machine, part human. Their slogan was, "Resistance is futile." They would come on board your good, clean, diverse, fun, exploratory starship and one by one take over the noble inhabitants, screw little gizmos onto their hands, little weird LED lights onto their eyes, and soon individuality would be only a distant memory. Lanier fears that something like Wikipedia is a hive mind, is about the Borg. But I would suggest that that's a partial point of view. I'll come back to that in a minute, but my early suggestion I would like to explore is that if you think of this as an internet service that is edited by a vast anonymous crowd, you could get the willies. That's the technical term for the great internet backlashes, the willies. But if you think of it not as hive mind or the Borg, you could think of it like Paris. Now, Paris was built by a vast anonymous crowd. At least it looks anonymous when seen from this distance. But we know that that's not the reality of how cities are put together. Even if we never know the names of the people who have built these impressive buildings, they were built by people, and they represent not a hive mind, but a network of human ambitions, human ideas, human accomplishments, just the way this skyline does. If you look at this and you say, oh no, here's where you lose your individuality, that would not necessarily be completely wrong, but it would rather miss the point, I think, if you've ever been to New York City and found the rich individuality everywhere, not only on display, but in active kinds of connection with each other. I think it can be anything but anonymous, especially if you're in the used record stores in Greenwich Village, but that's the last I'm going to say about my vinyl addiction today. Or St. Paul's Cathedral in London, built by a vast army of skilled artisans, people who poured their lives often into a project they would never see completed. I think Wikipedia is more like that than it's like a hive mind. But if you get the hive mind metaphor in your head, yes, you will get the willies. You will start to wonder if our individuality is being sucked into the great Borg where resistance is futile. If you think of it another way, however, it comes across rather differently. So that's Lanier. I'm starting with the thinker who, for me, is one of the more complex and interesting of the great internet backlashers. Though I enjoy his persona, I am much less impressed by Nicholas Carr. This is his recent book, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains, The Shallows. And this is the culmination of ideas that Nicholas Carr has been working on for several years. It started back with his great, oh, I guess he wouldn't object to it being sold on Amazon. Dear me, how did that slide get on there? What the internet is doing to our book sales and sales rank. And oh, it's also, you can have it on your Kindle in under a minute. Doggone that internet. Why don't they just shut it off? Well, sorry, I digress. Let's go back to July. Not that I'm suggesting he's disingenuous, just not looking at the bigger picture, which is always the challenge for us as human beings, as educators. It's certainly the challenge my students face, certainly the challenge I do. So this goes back to July, August, his famous article in the Atlantic Monthly in 2008, Is Google Making Us Stupid? Which is a great title. You could substitute a number of things for Google. Is sex making us stupid? Well, sure. What's your point? Etc., right? Is McDonald's making us fat? And so forth. And Carr writes, when the net absorbs a medium, right? We've got the metaphor already. It's like when the Manhattan skyline absorbs individuals, when the Borg absorb all the people, right? Okay. That medium is recreated in the net's image. Ah, what is the net's image? Well, Carr's image of the net is not mine. It's also not the image of the net at its best as it exists today. It's also very much not the image of the net as built by its founders. But let's go on. What is this net's image? It injects the medium's content. This is terrible. This is like being strapped to a gurney somewhere with people feeding you drugs, and it's this nightmarish 1984. It injects the medium's content with hyperlinks, blinking ads, and other digital gewgaws, and it surrounds the content with the content of all the other media it has absorbed. A new email message, for instance, may announce its arrival as we're glancing over the latest headlines at a newspaper's site. The result is to scatter our attention and diffuse our concentration. No email message has popped up for me yet. I guess I didn't design my computer experience around that, at least not today. I see. So instead of the net coming and holding guns to our heads and insisting that we be injected with gewgaws and so forth, perhaps there is here a brief lesson in giving up agency, using the passive voice in interesting ways to suggest that these things just happen. Well, maybe, maybe not. We do actually have some control over where we point our browsers, what we allow to be displayed, and whether we keep the Microsoft Exchange notification on or off. There is an off switch. But let's go farther. Carr continues to work on this, and this for me, alas, is the high point in July, August, in the Atlantic Monthly, again, this time this year. He writes, this is the big ideas issue of the Atlantic Monthly cover story, Are Men Necessary?, which is another one of those rhetorical questions. Google's like a nosy mother, intent on knowing everything her children are doing and thinking. Worse yet, it's like a meddlesome mother, the kind who can't let her kids do anything on their own. Start typing a keyword and she immediately butts in, trying to finish it for you. At first you enjoy the hyperactive solicitousness, but then you begin to bridle. You're being smothered. This is rather a different version of the Borg. It's like the Thanksgiving dinner Borg, where don't you want some poor mashed potatoes? Can I feed you one more thin after dinner mint? This is a nightmare version of what I would say is not so much a fear of Google as it is fear, uncertainty, and doubt propagated by various kinds of problematic mothers in Nicholas Carr's life, including the one in Alfred Hitchcock's immortal Valentine to his mother, called Psycho. So, okay, so maybe Nicholas Carr is acting out, projecting, maybe he's surrendering certain kinds of agency because he wants to believe that the devil made him do it, Google ate his homework, and his mother fed him too much. What about Sherry Turkle? An early advocate of cyberspace as an essential, new, and bracing testing ground for identity, for community, for collaboration. Sherry Turkle is someone whose early work I admire tremendously for its keen psychological insights into how this new, vast, strange, compelling cyberspace could actually give us new opportunities to think about intellectual development, personal integrity, the very notion of identity itself. She had a very interesting and often very playful attitude toward the possibilities. She insists that she has not recanted. I'm not sure. This is the next volume in The Great Internet Backlash, published by Basic Books in January 2011. That's what's projected. And it's called Alone Together. Dr. Turkle is already out on her book tour. Even though the book's not yet out, she's laying the groundwork, I think, for it, and that's fine, with a series of speaking engagements. I heard her talk about these ideas at the Campus Technology Conference back in July in Boston. And there she began to explore what are familiar ideas from the Great Internet Backlash. Her particular issue is with smartphones and texting and with the apps on your smartphone. She seems particularly bothered by the idea that we're not speaking to each other on the telephone anymore, which for her, unlike for an earlier generation, is really pretty much as good as face-to-face. It's the same thing. Go back 100 years, and all the fear was, well, if you're on the telephone, then you're not talking to your next-door neighbor. I mean, it's interesting how these fears shift over time. But when Turkle discusses this, she gets extremely concerned and expresses this in very passionate ways. Her cautions are often well taken. But I want to suggest that she's part of the same internet backlash, again, because of a failure of imagination. It looks like a hive mind. It could be New York City. It looks like the Borg. It could be St. Paul's Cathedral. But the thing about the internet is we build it as we go along. So to some extent, what shape it takes and what we think about it depends on our own imaginations. Our brains are that way too, but I'll come back to that. This is the product description from the Amazon.com placeholder page for Turkle's new book. And the description, as you can see up there, talks about Facebook. Of course it talks about Facebook. Facebook has 500 million subscribers, and that's growing. I saw the statistic expressed in another way that was even more challenging. If you take any 14 people across the planet, statistically speaking, it's a good chance one of them will have a Facebook account. Now that's staggering. This is a service that's been in existence 5 years or so. And of course, there are huge issues with Facebook. And in many ways, Facebook is, I think, a good example of how things can go awry if we're not careful. And yet, we must ask ourselves, are people addicted to Facebook because it's a narcotic? Is there nothing good here? If it's a hive mind, is there a St. Paul's Cathedral somewhere in there? Or could we build one? Or could we insist that Facebook build one? Well, I don't know. These questions are still open questions. Not so much for Dr. Terkel, who says that, well, in the description of her book, it is said, I should say, it's a nuanced exploration of what we're looking for and sacrificing in a world of electronic companions and social networking tools. And that's a fair summary of what I heard her say at the conference. You'll notice what's not there. It is not a nuanced exploration of what we are finding or building or hoping for in a world of electronic companions and social networking tools. That's not there. And yet, of course, the distinctive feature of the web is that we weave it. Yes, I published my first web page with no license, no entry fee, just a little bit of HTML. I remember the moment. It was magical. You're kidding me. I just put something out there for the world to see? What? Yeah, at a little Windows X terminal back in the computer science department back in 1994, I guess it was, in the little, you know, haven for geeks where all of us early adopters would hang out and look at this thing that would come over a 14.4 connection. Yes, I needed no license. It was the World Wide Web. But now the vision has turned starker and more fearful. And Dr. Terkel's book will contain an argument, we are told, that despite the hand-waving of today's self-described prophets of the future, also known as techno-determinists, techno-utopians, techno-determinopians, you can make up your own word. The idea is that gaggle of people waving their hands, like me, who insist that there is hope, there is something left for us to build. Despite the hand-waving of today's self-described prophets of the future, it will be the next generation who will chart the path between isolation and connectivity. Fair enough. The next generation is going to chart all the paths because they will be living while we are not. So that's sort of how that works. But when it comes to hand-waving, and with all due respect and some sadness, because I admire her earlier work so much, there's a hand-waving prophet of the future, Sherry Terkel. And at a talk at Harvard back in May when this book tour was beginning, Terkel speaks and says, as we instant message, email, text, and Twitter. Actually, the verb is tweet, but okay. Technology redraws the boundaries between intimacy and solitude. Teenagers avoid the telephone, fearful that it reveals too much. Besides, it takes too long. They would rather text than talk. Adults, too, choose keyboards over the human voice. Well, maybe. She's done a lot of field work. She's a clinical psychologist, and I respect data. At the same time, I've got a little experiment going on in my house, raising a 16-year-old daughter. And at this point, though she texts about 7,000 text messages a month, which is, roughly speaking, an average for people in her demographic, she explains to me that when she doesn't call, it's because she doesn't want to be rude. Not that it would take too long or that being on the telephone would reveal her inner psyche to somebody. She does the telephone too. She even does a lovely little thing on the iPhone right now called Heytel, which if you haven't seen it is this great little walkie-talkie application, which means that my daughter can play with her iPhone and I can relive the days when I was 8 years old and got the thing off the TV that would be the walkie-talkie. So that's a great meeting ground. But she says, Dad, if you text someone, they can read it and respond when it's convenient. If you call them, you're potentially interrupting them. So you should wait until you need to do that before you do that. This is not someone who is trembling, hiding behind a veil of ones and zeros. This is someone who is thinking about social interaction differently. Well, of course. That's one of the things we are not only allowed to do, but one of the things we are free and can interestingly do with these new technologies. Probably the most chilling moment for me in listening to Dr. Turkle speak of what in many cases are wise and profound cautions was the way in which she characterized the basic impulses behind people's desire to connect with these technologies. And she said these words, "Loneliness is failed solitude." Now, it is true that we need to learn to be alone and fruitfully alone. It is true that always on connectivity, which we do have some say in ourselves, do we not, can be not a good thing, but a bad thing. It's true that compulsive anything has grave dangers, but I don't think it's true that loneliness is failed solitude. If that were true, we would have failed that test in coming to this conference. I would be failing the test right now, speaking with you. We would have failed the test a long time ago when human beings discovered language. You want profound solitude? Get rid of words. Now you're locked in. Oh, yes, you are. And she said this multiple times as if these teens who are texting their hearts and their souls, and sometimes other body parts, I wish they would not. She suggested that these teens are somehow incomplete human beings, and their desires to be in touch with each other, and even my daughter's ability to be in conversations with the friends she left behind in Virginia, the friends she made in Texas when we moved there, and her grandfather, her father, her mother, her brother away at college, etc., that somehow this means she is psychically damaged because loneliness is failed solitude. I think that's an extreme statement. It worries me, and it makes me think that maybe proceeding with the great internet backlash, we are not going to be designing a better world by putting the genie back in the bottle. We're going to ignore the great lessons and opportunities that the net and the web have presented us. How much reality can we stand? How much reality do we need? Well, if you want to build something, you'll need some. And you'll need an imaginative approach to it. Look at this bit of technology. We don't think of it as technology, of course. It's just what's there. I forget who said this, but it's great. Technology is what was invented after you were born. That's the shorthand. The tyrant's foe, the people's friend, the printing press, one of the most marvelously, insanely disruptive technologies ever. Entire nations crumbled to dust as a result of the printing press. Western civilization was disrupted in a way that was permanent by the printing press. Any nut with a printing press could print a broadsheet. How would you know where that came from? Many of them were anonymous. Anonymous because people feared for their lives, also because people wanted to hide. Misinformation, crazy fables, awful, terrible, slanderous, libelous things, all from the printing press. Is a printing press failed humanity? I don't think so. It amplifies our freedom. It amplifies our being. Are we afraid of that? Of course we are. But that doesn't mean that we should forsake freedom. These questions go way, way back. I'm going to touch on a domain here that actually was my dissertation area, Milton studies. And what is a good Miltonist like me doing with a PowerPoint slide like this? I don't know. But here we go. Milton took up the question in the 17th century, is paradise making us evil? Never mind Google making us stupid. It's an interesting question. Is our humanity somehow booby-trapped, rigged? Was there something wrong with the particular architecture in the myth of Adam and Eve? Is this a story about freedom or a story about entrapment? Milton came down pretty securely on the side of freedom. He wrote some interesting words in his famous tract on freedom of the press. Now, it was not full freedom of the press, but it was an argument against pre-publication censorship. And he writes, "Many there be that complain of divine providence for suffering that is allowing Adam to transgress. What was God thinking? Maybe God's making us stupid. Foolish tongues. When God gave Adam reason, he gave him freedom to choose. For reason, critical thinking, enlightened awareness, is but choosing. He had been else a mere artificial Adam, such an Adam as he is in the puppet shows. God therefore left him free, set before him a provoking object, that tree with the fruit, ever almost in his eyes. Herein consisted his merit, herein the right of his reward, the praise of his abstinence." In other words, the ability to choose the wrong thing is an essentially defining characteristic of freedom. Freedom in a world in which all the sharp corners are gone, all the walls are padded, all the seats are bolted to the floor. Gosh, it starts to sound like a classroom, doesn't it? That's not a free world. If it's free, you could choose incorrectly. You might get hurt. That's what freedom means. Milton's formula, in the end, is that Adam and Eve were sufficient to have stood, though free to fall. And the idea is that both of those things have to be true at the same time. Part of what I'm trying to argue today is that unless we believe that of our students and ourselves, take it out of the theological context, make falling simply making a wrong choice, we are not really embracing freedom, or what these technologies can bring to us as free human beings. Maybe it's time for a reformation. I'm going to continue the Renaissance thing for a while. Bear with me. Martin Luther, October 31st, 1517, nailing 95 theses to the Wittenberg door. Maybe it didn't happen, but it's an interesting metaphor. There, the idea is against indulgences, and restoring an idea that was not different from the roots of Christian theology. It was, Luther said, at the root of Christian theology. But it had to do with this idea of freedom. It had to do with not selling indulgences. And I want to extend this metaphor and ask, as educators, what are the indulgences we are selling our students and ourselves? What is the freedom that we could substitute usefully, and to what extent can the net and the web foster that freedom? So there are the 95 theses Luther nailed to the door, except it's a copy. The ones he nailed to the door were written out, we believe, but within a year there were thousands and thousands of reprints with this new technology, the printing press, and this started the entire Protestant Reformation, which permanently changed the civilization of the world. What are the 95 theses we can nail to the door today based on the World Wide Web? Well, you can tell if when you bring it up in conversation with faculty, they get really upset. And faculty get really upset about lots of things. I know, I am one. I'm perpetually upset. So you can bring up tenure and promotion. That'll get you going. Absolutely. You can bring up teaching loads. Yes. If you really want to get them going, bring up parking. Never fails. But consistently, when I talk to faculty, and I talk to faculty a fair amount because I am one, so they let me in. Are we exclusive? A little bit. When I do talk to faculty, there's typically one thing that, for me, becomes the 95 theses, the place where it's like, hey, bud, you have gone too far now. And it's called Wikipedia. I think Wikipedia is the 95 theses of our day because it, in many respects, gets back to the roots of what we say we want, but not on our terms. It's a very sad story, of course. Wikipedia began as a thing called Newpedia, which was going to be peer-reviewed, written only by experts, vetted thoroughly, authoritative, reliable, all of those great things that we professors bring to the world, you know, ironclad, rock-solid stability. Okay, I'm exaggerating, but you get the idea. You wouldn't be able to go into Newpedia and make a mistake. You wouldn't have any bad choices. We would have given you the best of our great, brilliant minds. And when the folks who set up Newpedia got it going, they noticed something very quickly. Nothing happened. Well, we're all very busy, you see, we faculty. Absolutely, we're extremely busy, very, very busy, and busy. So who has time to do anything like blog, tweet? Well, tweet's kind of like, I don't know, hula hoops anyway, but you know, we have very important things to do. Help construct an encyclopedia on the World Wide Web? Well, that's a nice idea, but no, we can't really be doing it. So nothing happened. No articles were written, zero activity. So in a desperation move, you might say a Hail Mary pass, the founders of Newpedia said, okay, this is built on wiki technology. In theory, anyone could do this. Why don't we just throw it wide open? What have we got to lose? And then the result was Wikipedia, the single most impressive and extensive reference work ever constructed by human beings. Not perfect, just a miracle. And when you bring up Wikipedia, faculty get all upset about this because it's not properly vetted. All those things we had a chance to do, sorry, we were too busy, and now it's here. Ugh, what are we going to do? So I was talking with a group of folks just a couple of days ago, a group of social workers, as it happens. And I want to start this story by saying these are good people. These are caring people. These are people who've devoted their lives to educating other people in the best ways to be supportive of individual dignity, of community, of integrity. So I say this with, again, a lot of sadness. But I brought up in this group of social workers the social work article on Wikipedia. And I said, how many of you have looked at this? In a room of about 150 people, about 5 hands went up. I said, well, that's too bad. If anyone ever wants to know anything about you and your profession, they will Google it, and if you Google any topic of general interest known to humankind at this point in the history of civilization, somewhere on the first page, I would wager in the first 5 links, Wikipedia will come up. Wikipedia will come up probably before the American Association of Social Workers, or National Association of Social Workers it is, or even the International Association of Social Workers. It's probably going to be Wikipedia. Doggone that Wikipedia. Everybody loves it. We all use it, even if we don't admit it. And they're going to find out there. Well, the answer is clear. Great. You're a social worker. You're a professional. Go edit Wikipedia. Not hard. In fact, it's perilously easy. That's the idea. A wiki is constructed not to make it hard to make a mistake, but to make it easy to fix one. Ah, different paradigm. So I talked about the supposed anonymity of Wikipedia. Sometimes, yes, but you will see that there are all these labeled names in Wikipedia. In fact, if you actually look at Wikipedia, instead of not looking at Wikipedia, and you start to click on the links, you will find that there are people in Wikipedia who take great pains to make their contributions to this great cathedral known and identifiable. There's a thing called user pages, and you'll see that Ursa Sapien, and that's not, I think, a Baylor person, even though everybody at Baylor is somehow connected to bears. It's true. I myself have got some grizzly in me. Ursa Sapien is the one who has edited the most times. And what do we know about Ursa Sapien? We know what Ursa Sapien is saying. We know something about what Ursa Sapien values. Could this all be fake? Of course it could. I could be too. How many of you read my CV before you came this morning? Okay, a couple of you. The rest of you? I'm actually Jaron Lanier. I'm not Gardner Campbell. Can you prove otherwise? No, we take so much of what we do when we interact with each other on faith based on the recommendation of others. That works for this too. Ursa Sapien actually gives us rather a lot of information about whoever he or she is. Not anonymous, but pseudonymous, and in many respects, eager to make his or her contribution to this skyline, this cathedral, not only known, but valued. So after I was talking with my colleagues, I went back to the back, and there was a small knot of people in the room, and I said, so I was really kind of surprised that very few people in the room had gone to look at the article on social work in Wikipedia. And one of my colleagues said, well, I'm not surprised. We forbid them to look at it. I said, I'm sorry? You don't let them go look at it? Oh, no, we don't let them use it in their papers when they're writing their papers for us. And there was a healthy population of students who had been in the room. I said, well, of course you don't. I wouldn't either. I don't let my students use encyclopedias as primary sources in their research papers. But you see, the problem was it was Wikipedia, not the notion of encyclopedia. And the first thing out of this person's mouth was, we don't let them look at it, which suggests that maybe we're over into this fear zone. And I said, well, have you ever asked your students to edit Wikipedia? And one of the people standing in the small circle said, you know, I didn't even know you could. This is someone who does not know the essential defining characteristic that drives so much of the fear about Wikipedia. A grown human being, that's sort of like not knowing it's the courts, the legislature, and the executive branch. It's not a good thing. Not a good thing at all. And then another colleague piped up and said, well, the little German corporal in me wishes that you couldn't just go in and edit it. And I said, but you know, the fact that you don't have to apply for the license means that you could go home tonight, look at the article, and spend 5 minutes making one sentence better. If enough people spend 5 minutes making one sentence better over the course of a year, that's what Clay Shirky calls cognitive surplus, and that's the thing that makes Wikipedia go. Not some egghead like me laboring over an article that I'll finish 10 years later, maybe. Instead, let's just all take a minute and pick up one can, pull up one weed, plant one flower. Why not? It'll take 5 minutes. And then alas, the person said, you know, I could do that, but I think I would really rather go home and work on chapter 4. Which, of course, is the book this colleague was writing. And I thought at that minute, right. These are the indulgences we sell ourselves in the professoriate. These are the terrible environments we have set up that our students learn from. What we would rather do as professionals, instead of spending 5 minutes making the world's most consulted reference source a little bit better, is go back and write chapter 4. And maybe it's a perfectly good chapter 4. I'm not saying it isn't, but the priorities are a little messed up. To be fair, the system supports it. This, of course, is an assembly line. It could also be a curriculum. It could also be a tenure portfolio. We set up all of these systems that say very clearly what our priorities are. And I've been in these faculty meetings. I am one. They let me in. And what we do is look at the CV and count. Kind of a gross assessment. Or we can think about this metaphor. Again, this could be coming up for your dissertation defense. Not a bad thing if it's done well. It could be your tenure process. Often a bad thing, seldom done well. It could be what Clydesdale calls the liberal arts gen ed hazing that our students endure. Or that's how it seems to them when they come in. That's probably the English composition requirement he's enduring at that moment. It shouldn't be that way. It should be St. Paul's Cathedral. It shouldn't be the Borg. It should be school. It shouldn't be a feedlot. But that's the way it seems. And we keep building this for each other. And we don't have time to edit Wikipedia. As an alternative, I want to propose, and here's where things are going to get a little more hopeful, an idea of digital citizenship, embracing the net that we are embracing the web we can weave together, finding the St. Paul's Cathedral and the Manhattan skyline in the midst of what seems to be, looked at another way, a hive mind. And more than that, enabling our students to understand this and empowering them to be free within this world we are building together. My model is Benjamin Franklin. Largely self-taught, oops, didn't have that degree. He did okay. A polymath, actually an aggressive interdisciplinarian, scientist, writer, publisher, diplomat, political scientist. And in the words of Walter Isaacson, in his monumental biography of Franklin from just a few years ago, a successful publisher and consummate networker with an inventive curiosity who would have felt right at home in the information revolution. Benjamin Franklin was not a gadget. Sometimes he wrote pseudonymously or anonymously. He began his public life when he was 16. I'm glad he was alive. There he is in the print shop, getting his hands dirty with the technology. No necessary division between knowing how to set the type and thinking about how to write what he was publishing. An interesting image. And if you look up Franklin in the Oxford English Dictionary, which you should, the Oxford English Dictionary is hours of fun for anybody interested in the historical development of language, you find out he had an interesting surname. Back in the day when people in England were getting their last names, they would either get names related to their titles as aristocrats, Lancaster, or they'd get titles related to the things they did as artisans, weaver, tailor, smith. But some folks got surnames that spoke of their own condition in an interesting way. This is my favorite. Franklin means a freeholder, a free person. Benjamin Freeholder, Benjamin Freedom, Benjamin the free person. If our students and our faculty learn to be digital citizens, they will have the freedom of the web, the freedom of the net, the freedom of their humanity. But we have to do it together, and we have to think differently to get there. I don't have a 12-step program. Five, I think, is all I've got. But I'll talk about some of this briefly just to give you an idea of where my mind is going. Imperfect, inadequate, work in progress. I welcome your thoughts. Everyone kind of understands about information literacy. This has been going on for 20 years, maybe 15, if you count it from the advent of the web. The idea is we have to equip our students to be able to read and think critically about the information they find out there in that vast, woolly, unvetted territory that we call the internet. Absolutely. And yet we get stuck there. And then it becomes a set of, oh, be careful when you go to New York, be careful when you go to New York, be careful when you go to New York, be careful when you go to New York. And that doesn't get us where we need to be. Next step. Digital fluency. If you're literate, you can read. If you're fluent, you can read and you can write. We need to be able to equip our students for true digital fluency. We need to teach them how to make a good mashup, a good remix. All those things that we're kind of worried about. Shouldn't we have term papers instead of YouTube videos? I don't know. Depends on how clever the YouTube video is. Depends on how dry and boring the term paper is. If I get a term paper that says for thousands of years, men and women all over the world, I would much rather watch a video, frankly, if it's a good one. So we have to bring these opportunities for digital fluency into the way we think about teaching and learning. And we have to be prepared to learn from our students as well. We may not understand how to assess these things. They may have ideas that can help us. I think that's kind of interesting. But then there are two more steps that are very, very strange. I'm going to try to explain them in the brief time I have left. And I offer them to you as bones for your minds to chew on, things to be puzzled or perhaps even outraged by. First is meta-medium thinking. This is an essential part of digital citizenship, as is the ability to construct a personal cyber infrastructure. All of this adding up to digital citizenship. What is meta-medium thinking? The folks who built the internet, personal computers, interactive computing, the people that we think about today as the visionaries and architects of the information age, understood that these computers we were building had interesting and unique properties. Alan Kay, in 1977, in an article that he wrote with Adele Goldberg while they were both at Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, wrote, "The ability to simulate the details of any descriptive model means that the computer, viewed as a medium itself, can be all other media if the embedding and viewing methods are sufficiently well provided. We think the implications are vast and compelling." Now, what does that mean? Well, later, just a few days ago, Alan Kay, leaving a comment on one of my colleagues' blog posts, wrote, "One way to look at what we were doing is that we were trying to make new kinds of books and telescopes and microscopes, etc., to advance seeing and thinking. But if you give a microscope to a monkey, they will only hold it up to admire their reflection in the shiny brass barrel." And to that extent, I agree that we do need to look at the internet again. There is far too much of the looking at our reflections in the shiny brass barrel, but it's a microscope. And Kay goes on, "I think this is what happened. Education never got on the bus, and the augmentation of human intellect, which is right there," and he's quoting someone else, I'll get to this in just a second, "got completely overwhelmed by the mirror effect." How do we know when our students have meta-medium thinking? I had a student just a few weeks ago read this passage in the same essay I quoted from a couple of slides back. This passage about music being synthesized by the Dynabook, about the way in which the Dynabook, which really is the laptop that we have today in many respects, was going to be a kind of, potentially, music synthesizer. And my student said, "Wait a minute. I thought we had computers, and then musicians figured out ways they could kind of make the computers do musical things. But that's not what happened, is it?" I said, "Go on." He said, "Musicians who wanted to do certain kinds of things invented computers." Right. That's meta-medium thinking. And it's very, very rare. It's hiding in plain sight. You can find this whole essay up on the web. Personal cyber infrastructure. If we want our students, if we want to be full digital citizens, we had better understand how to be on the web. And the idea of the personal cyber infrastructure is to be able to knit our own web within a web, to assert our digital presence not simply by downloading something or reading a newspaper online, but having our own web servers. This is the screenshot from the web server I rent space on, my little web server apartment space. It's on a commodity shared hosting service called Bluehost, but there are dozens of them out there. And what I have here are buttons I can click on to be able to control various aspects of the website that I run at gardnercampbell.net. That makes me a digital citizen because I don't understand all of this, but I know enough to be able to do some DIY work. And once I'm in there, I have access to an amazing variety of free open source affordances that I can use and do use in my own work as well as in my students' work. The WordPress multi-user site that I set up shortly after I got to Baylor was running on this service, not the school's. It cost $7.99 a month. I had my blog, my wife's blog on it anyway. Why not toss up a little WordPress multi-user blog site for my, why not? Took a click or two, I was done. I want my students to be able to do this as well. Look at all of this, PHPBB, Drupal, Moodle, run your own little school out of this. Ah, that would be the point. And when all of that adds up, it adds up to something, it seems to me, that's very, very hopeful and potentially quite impressive. I'd like to let John Udell speak to you for just a minute about this web we could weave together and what is so exciting about the prospects.
But this notion of context as a service that we provide to one another was really the kind of the key thing. And there was a moment where this kind of crystallized for me, something that Dave Weiner talked about, I can't remember when, but You know, what happened is that one day something interesting happened in the .NET space. And Dave noted it on his blog. But the thing was that Dave didn't really know too much about the .NET world. Right? He only knew that there was this blogger and that blogger and then the other blogger who he trusted as authorities in that space. And every once in a while, one of them would blog something, and he would say, oh, you know, that seems like it might be interesting. And another day, another one of them would pop up and say something. He would sort of take note of it. And then one day, all three of these guys fired at the same time, basically. And he went, aha, you know, that means, by definition, something interesting and important happened in the .NET space today, right? Like, I just know that a priori because the network told me. And when I reflect on that now and when I talk about that now, I use the terminology that I use is summation. And, you know, I the term comes from biology, right? And it's what happens in a nervous system where you have, you know, three neurons impinging on a fourth, right? And the signal isn't going to propagate unless all three of the inputs fire. You know, one or two won't do it, right? So what I actually assert is that this human network that we're creating of contextual filters for one another is, in some sense, it's literally a nervous system, right? It's a nervous system writ large. And so, you know, PubSub for me is hugely important.
And by PubSub, what he means is publication and subscription. It's the activity of publishing things to the web and following other people who publish things to the web. And Udell's point is that this is creating a global nervous system in which the network itself, like a brain, has certain modes in which it actually alerts itself to the fact something interesting has happened. It's hard to wrap your head around that, but no harder than trying to wrap your head around your own brain, which, oddly, your brain is equipped to do. That's interesting. If this net, this web, can have that element as well, if we can empower our students to continue to build this global nervous system, that, to me, takes care of many of the legitimate concerns of the great internet backlash and points to a paradigm that goes beyond the fear of freedom. It also gives us a way to talk not just about these Benjamins, but the free Benjamin as well. Walt Whitman in Leaves of Grass says very stirring words in the 19th century. I speak the password primeval. I give the sign of democracy. By God, I will accept nothing which all cannot have their counterpart of on the same terms. So that's the dream. It is alive on the net, on the web, if we weave it, if we keep it alive. Benjamin Franklin at the end of the Constitutional Convention was asked, what do we have? And he said, a republic, if you can hang on to it. This is the cover of a book that I admire. It's a great rant, it's a great screed. Ted Nelson's Computer Lib. On the other side it says Dream Machines. And the slogan is, you can and must understand computers now. Self-published, whoops, 1974. Education ought to teach and reward initiative, curiosity, the habit of self-motivation, intellectual involvement, Nelson writes. And then he goes on, educators and computer enthusiasts tend to agree on these goals, but what happens? Many of the inhumanities of the existing system, no less wrong for being unintentional, are being continued into computer-assisted teaching. True. And when Lanier, in his, I think, more reasonable and perceptive moments, talks about what he fears, I think that's a legitimate thing to fear and something that we can avoid. He writes in the New York Times in September of 2010, roughly speaking, there are two ways to use computers in the classroom. You can have them measure and represent the students and the teachers, or you can have the class build a virtual spaceship. And that's his metaphor for that meta-medium thinking, that personal cyber infrastructure, weaving that web, building that global nervous system. He goes on, right now the first way is ubiquitous, but the virtual spaceships are being built only by tenacious oddballs in unusual circumstances. More spaceships, please. In that New York Times article, that was the illustration that ran, and you can see that the idea is this is technology used poorly. But note that technology has a very wide meaning in this room. The villain is not the screens at the front. The villain is the windowless, bare room with the ugly fluorescent lights with all the desks facing in the same direction. That's not a virtual spaceship. Those screens used correctly could turn it into a virtual spaceship, despite the best designs of whoever makes these kinds of sterile classrooms. Or they could simply be yet another part of the harsh fluorescent lighting. There are a couple of screens. There's a classroom. The fault, dear Brutus, lies not in our screens. It lies in what we do with them. This was an EDUCAUSE Learning Initiative conference. The screen at the right is the Twitter back channel, and these students are participating in it because they know how to use Twitter and hashtags. These are first-year students in the first weeks of their college education interacting in an international conference with experts from around the world. Not too bad. I'll move to the end now with a couple of more visionary statements. This is Douglas Engelbart. This is the person who coined the term augmenting human intellect, who wrote a paper in 1962 that inspired some folks to give him some money to work on this crazy idea called interactive computing. Engelbart is typically thought of as the man who invented the mouse, but that's like saying Leonardo da Vinci did some jottings in a notebook. It's true, but it's not quite the whole story. And to get back to what Jaime said so movingly to me at the beginning, it really is about the dream of what Engelbart called, in that essay, an integrated domain. This is the vision for interactive computing from 1962. Engelbart writes, "We do not speak of isolated clever tricks that help in particular situations. We refer to a way of life in an integrated domain where hunches, cut and try, intangibles, and the human feel for a situation, we are not a gadget, usefully coexist with powerful concepts, streamlined terminology and notation, sophisticated methods, and high-powered electronic aids." Not a feedlot, scaling up for workforce market preparation. Not an environment in which all of these warnings put people in a zone of fear. As they say in that wonderful movie, Brazil, suspicion breeds confidence. But confidence in what? Not a habit trail, clearly laid out, easily organized, bathrooms hidden at the back so the visitors won't see it, etc. But a habitat, a web we weave together, a net that is us. In Here Comes Everybody, Clay Shirky writes, "We are living in the middle of the largest increase in expressive capability in the history of the human race. We had better not be gadgets living at this time, but we have to be prepared to be digital citizens." Louis Pasteur famously wrote, "Chance favors the prepared mind." In a book that just came out this month called Where Good Ideas Come From, Stephen Berlin Johnson tweaks that a little bit. You might say he hacks it. Chance favors the connected mind. We've never in human history had so many opportunities for so many different kinds of profound connections. TED Talks, some of my favorite moments on the web, and this one is especially resonant. "We are not our genomes," Sebastian Sung argues, "that neuroscience is teaching us we are our connectomes, the map of the web, the network, the neural connections inside our brains." As Janet Murray writes, "The task is the same now as it ever has been. Familiar, thrilling, unavoidable. We work with all our myriad talents to expand our media of expression to the full measure of our humanity. There are a few things to fear there. There's a lot to celebrate. There's work to be done. And you can all do it with no license. 5 minutes, Wikipedia, make an edit, change the world. If the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite. Thank you.